chicken? It was really the chicken skin.
Fine.
It was like you also the real
relationship. Hit her.
So you think he's a junior high then?
Okay, last week, we have a little housekeeping from last week. Last week, there was a question asked as to whether Arius was actually at the Council of Nicaea. And I mumbled and stood around looking at the floor and scuffing my shoes and saying, I think so. So I want to make sure that I answered that this week. And I did a lot of research on it, and interestingly enough, different sources sort of say different things about this. Most of them point to the fact that as I thought, Arius was there. Our text actually here, The Story of Christianity by Gonzalez, which is the book that I recommend as the resource for the class, it says that Arius was there, but he wasn't allowed to participate because he wasn't a bishop. That was the only place I had found that. My favorite one of all the places of these stories that I found about Arius and the Council of Nicaea was that Arius was, according to this story, was in a heated theological debate with another bishop. And it got to be so heated that this bishop actually slapped Arius in the face. I mean, that's how heated this was. Now, this probably wouldn't be anything more than just a good personal assault case in a courtroom, but the bishop that slapped him was an interesting guy. The bishop that slapped him was the bishop. His name was Nicholas, and he was from this town of Myra, a small town in what's now modern day Turkey. And Nicholas was known as this incredible philanthropist. He gave money and gifts and stuff to people constantly. So much so that after he died, they made a saint out of him, Saint Nicholas. And he ended up becoming the patron saint of Christmas. And so Arius now has the dubious distinction of not only being one of the great heretics of the Christian church, but he's the only guy I know of who was ever slapped in the face by Santa Claus. So it's just one of those great stories that comes out of history. Whether it's apocryphal or not, I love it, that Santa Claus just slapped old Arius up. Tonight we're going to move into really strongly into the medieval period. We've sort of left the ancient period behind. The way historians sort of block up history, they sort of have big chunks, but they're never really clear as to when these things start. Unless there's a cataclysmic event or a big battle or something, these things are always a little iffy. And normally the ancient period sort of ends with the fall of Rome, which is 476. I think 476, pretty sure that's it. And then we say that from there on we have the medieval period. And the end of the medieval period, they're a little loosey-goosey on that as well. I like to take it up to about the Reformation. Sort of the Renaissance is the end of it. But for our purposes here, because it's church history, we'll take it up to the Reformation. So we're in the medieval period. Now, when we talk about the medieval period, it depends on who you're talking to as to whether this was a good time or a bad time. Most folks view the medieval period, especially the early part of the medieval period, up till, into the 10th century, 11th century, something like that. They view it as being this terrible, dark place where you just don't have, society is all closed in and it's this horrible place. And then you have other folks that view the medieval period as this really good time, as a time of where really Christianity kind of ruled the day. And folks that don't like the medieval period say, no, it was a dark, terrible time where people were oppressed and they lived in poverty and the church put people down, and it wasn't until the Renaissance with the awakening of the human spirit and neoclassicism that society blossomed again. And so, depending on which camp you're in, you can like it or not like it.
When did the Black Death come across Europe?
The plague was... what are the dates for the plague? 13? See, this is the second week you've asked me a question I don't have a good answer for. The dates of the plague. I do not know the dates of the plague off the bat.
Would they be, which era would they be?
It's during the medieval period.
But it's toward the latter end of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I do not have the dates of that's terrible. I should know that because that was a big deal. I'll find it out for next week. Wait till next week and you will find the dates. Or you can just go home and Google it. And I'm sure Wikipedia will give you something close to a real answer. But the medieval period is interesting because it is a time of huge contrasts. We like to think of ourselves as folks who are, you know, we're really together. We're actually postmodern. The modern period is actually sort of ended, and we're postmodern now. But we think of ourselves as scientific and intelligent and smart and civilized and all this other stuff. And so we have this weird way that we view history. And we sort of view anybody that came before us as sort of not as good as us, which is really a terrible way to view history. But we look at the medieval period and we go, oh, this was just horrible. But the medieval period had incredible contrast. There were unbelievably good things that occurred in the medieval period, okay? And there were other things that were just bizarre. And there's a quote that I want to read tonight. This is by a modern writer. The guy's name is Kevin A. Miller. And this is a quote from 1991, so there is one reference in here that's a little dated now, 10 years later. But this is from an article entitled From the Editor, In the Middle Ages of a Debate, from Christian History Magazine, issue 30, volume 10, number 2, 1991, page 6. You're tracking with this. But anyway, it's this idea of the medieval period, and I really like what Miller wrote here, so I want to read this. The medieval era is surely one of the most difficult for us to understand. People danced around the Maypole and built soaring cathedrals. They walked thousands of miles to view holy relics, and they lit bonfires to ward off dragons. They illuminated some of the most beautiful books ever made and fought plagues by carrying bouquets of flowers. They bathed in barrels and saw visions of angels. And, impossible for us to understand, a massive Christendom ruled over all. Kings and queens, abbots and abbesses, and countless peasant women and men. Because the cultural differences are so great, it's easy for us to question the faith of those believers of 700 or more years ago. We like things rational and orderly, so their emphasis on mystical visions perplexes us. We emphasize the individual, so their stress on communal life makes us blink. Here's the antiquated reference. We live in an age of the Playboy Channel, so their radical commitment to virginity strikes us as quaint. Certainly not everything in the medieval church could or should be imitated, but before we dismiss the practice of these saints as misguided, we need to consider, will Christians in the year 2690, if the Lord tarries, see us as kind of strange? Part of what Miller points up here is this huge contrast. People were hugely superstitious during the medieval period, okay? And they believed that there were, you know, angels in the rafters and devils under the bed, okay? And they believed that as much as you and I believe the science of the physical world that we know, okay? This was how they viewed the world. But at the same time, they were very practical, and they did incredible things. We'll talk in a minute about how monasticism preserved society, Western society. They did very astute, complex political things. They did complex theologies and stuff. And at the same time, they had these pagan sort of feasts where they did stuff that we look at as just nutty stuff. And the warp and woof of society in the medieval period was Christianity. We're not that way. We're a Christian nation. In the United States, everybody, you know, whatever the recent poll said, 80, 90% of the people say, oh, yes, I believe in God, and blah, 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 and a whole lot of folks go to church every day. But nobody believes that we order our... Well, as believers at this church, or my church, whatnot, we do this. But in general, in society, nobody sort of orders their life based on religious beliefs. We don't celebrate religious holidays, right? We celebrate Cinco de Mayo today, but that's not a religious holiday. That's a cheap excuse to have guacamole and margaritas, right? We celebrate St. Patrick's Day. There's a great religious holiday. But we don't celebrate religious feast days. We don't order our life based around the church calendar. We don't give authority to religious leaders at the level of almost life and death that we see in the medieval period. So this is a hard time for us sometimes to understand. And it's easy for us just to say, well, they were a bunch of nut jobs. And especially those of us in the Protestant tradition look at it and say, oh, that's those evil Roman papists just messing everything up. And yes, I don't agree with a whole lot of stuff that happened. But on the other hand, that's the continuum of the Christian church. The church that started on Pentecost in Acts 2 is the same church that went through this period. And it's the same church that went into the Reformation. And it's the same church that exists today. We're part of this continuum. The good, the bad, and the ugly of it, we're part of this continuum. So we can't just simply discount this or ignore it. And we also can't base what we do now on something that somebody said in, you know, 786 or something. We base what we believe on the Bible. But we understand that there are a whole lot of other folks who have worked through all this process as well, and we're part of this, all the good and all the bad. Okay, I tell people history is a lot like your family. Within any family, now I have a wonderful family, and I'm not just saying that because the microphone's turned on. I really do. I really love my side of the family. I love my wife's side of the family, but there are some crazy folks on both sides. Most of them are gone, but some of them still exist. If you talk to some of my nieces and nephews, they might say, oh yeah, my Uncle John's a nut guy. He's just crazy, right? But it's family. And we understand when people do crazy bad things, okay, they did some crazy nutty things. They're still family, but we can't deal with that. And then when other people do really great stuff, we go, yay, that's family. They're doing really great stuff. That's a lot like church history, okay? So we have to kind of view it that way. Okay, so the medieval period really comes into play, and the social order has broken down. I said over and over that Rome loved order in society, and Rome did anything it could to have order in society. The problem was Rome started to break down, as all nations do. It starts to break down for a whole variety of reasons. And nowadays it's very popular to say that, well, Rome fell apart because of all these various, and you can add in the particular thing that you don't like and blame Rome for it and say that that's the reason why Rome was destroyed. But it was a whole lot of things. It was corrupt leadership, it was foolishness in political and social decisions, it was the folks that ran the place was a very small minority of folks who were very wealthy and very fat and enjoyed life, and the folks that they sort of lived the life on the back of said, you know, we're not happy doing this anymore, supporting you guys. So there was a lot of breakdown there. But however it happened, Rome started to deteriorate. Now, in the book that I've recommended you guys have, this Story of Christianity by Gonzalez, on page 232, there's a map, and it shows Rome sort of in the center of the map, and it outlines all around it all the folks that surrounded Rome. Okay, it's not as if Rome existed as this Garden of Eden and there was nothing outside the boundary of Rome. The only people that existed in the world were simply in Italy. There was a whole lot of folks around Rome that were just doing all kinds of stuff. And when you take Western history, when you take world history, you learn about all these folks. You learn about the Saxons, and you learn about the Franks, and the Visigoths, and the Vandals, and the Goths, and the Huns, and everybody. Here's, for those of you that don't have the book, here's... and you see all these folks sort of surrounding Rome. Now, these guys were folks just like us, and just like the folks in Rome, okay? These were folks that had wives and kids, and they got up every day and they did whatever they needed to have food and to live their life, and they, you know, that's just how they were. And a lot of these guys looked at Rome and said, whoa, the Roman Empire is really great. I mean, it's relatively peaceful, there's protection there from the government, you don't have to worry about the guy coming across the little lake and burning down your village. This is a really good deal. And they sort of aspired to want to be part of that whole Roman thing, right? It's kind of like, you know, they talk about the American dream. Well, this was the barbarian dream, right? They wanted to be, and so they wanted part of that. So they wanted to get into Rome and get into all of this. Now, unfortunately, The Roman government did not set up a pathway to citizenship or give them green cards or anything like that to let the Goths into work in Upper Italy or something. The way you did things back then is you just simply came rolling into town, said, I'm going to set up my village here. And the folks who were there either said, okay, or they said, no, you're not. And everybody got out their axes and their clubs, and they beat the snot out of each other for a while. And whoever was left standing, they got the choice of where the village went. Okay, so it was not always an easy thing for these barbarians to come in and take the land that they wanted for their family. Rome didn't like them at all. Okay, Rome referred to all of them as barbarians. These guys didn't think of themselves as barbarians. They thought of themselves as Saxons or Goths or Vandals, whatever, you know. But so you have a lot of this stuff going on. And from the Roman perspective, the barbarians were at the gates and they were smashing in and they were doing terrible stuff. And civilization as we know it was going to heck in a handbasket. That was the Roman view. Everybody else was just trying to get their share of the barbarian dream. Okay, so there's huge turmoil going on. The other thing that occurs is a lot of these folks coming in from outside are Christian folks. Our friend Arius, the guy that got slapped by Santa Claus, his followers had gone out and taught these people. And they learned Christianity, but they learned Arian Christianity. Well, now what you have is not only do you have, from the Roman point of view, a barbarian, an uncouth individual from out in the hinterlands coming in to pitch his little mud hut next to where you have your fabulous villa. But these folks are theologically wrong too, because they practice the wrong form of Christianity. So now you not only have political and racial turmoil, you've got religious and theological tension. Not a good soup, okay? It's just nasty and everybody's fighting and everything. So this is where the church is here at the beginning of the medieval period. Now, because I don't have, you know, a whole year to teach this stuff, I have to sort of condense all of this down and give you the Cliff Notes version. So I want to talk about how the church dealt with all of this stuff through two institutions. One is monasticism, monks, monasteries. The other is the papacy. Because both of these things, I think, were the sort of highlight of a whole lot of the medieval period, and as well of how the church dealt with all this political and social turmoil that was going on. I want to start with monasticism. For a long time, back into the New Testament period, people chose to remove themselves from society for religious reasons. I mean, Jesus went out in the desert, right? Before he started his ministry. Folks in the early church would go off by themselves for a variety of reasons. Most people went out usually for one of two reasons, either to escape what they felt was a corrupt society, they wanted to go out by themselves, escape what was going on in the social order, or they felt the need to go out, not necessarily because society was bad, but for their own personal reason, that was the way they could become one with God. Now, what helped this along was two things. One, the idea that came from Greco-Roman philosophy that the body was divided in two parts, the spirit or the soul and the flesh. This was a non-biblical concept, by the way. The biblical concept is that God made this perfect creation, this unity which was mankind, which had both a material and an immaterial part, had a body and a soul. The soul part got corrupted because of sin, but it was still part of the body. And because the soul part was corrupted, the body started to want to go its own way and not go God's way. So the body had to be brought into line to go God's way, but the body wasn't bad. The Bible teaches that God is very interested in the physical health and enjoyment of his people. The Psalms talk about God giving us wine to gladden our heart, and the Bible talks about how we're to use our body in the service of God. Music is great if we use it, as Paul says, in hymns and psalms and inspired songs, right? The Bible teaches that sex is wonderful, not for when you engage with a temple prostitute or with the village adulteress, but within the bonds of a committed relationship, you know, the Song of Songs just gives you a gory detail about how wonderful your sex life is supposed to be. So God is really okay with our body. And God understands that the body and soul are together, and yeah, we have to, through the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, keep ourselves pure, but the body isn't bad. Well, Greco-Roman philosophy comes in, influences Christianity, and Christianity moves away from the Jewish view, and all of a sudden you get this dichotomy that now the flesh is bad, but the spirit's good. So we have to somehow, we have to beat our flesh into submission. Well, it was real easy when you could get martyred. When Christians were being persecuted, that was real easy, because you could stand up for the faith and somebody would cut you down. And what a great testimony to God, and what a wonderful punishment to your body. I will get my body killed in the service of the Lord. But what happened is suddenly Christianity became the religion of the world, of the state. You couldn't get martyred anymore. Oh, what are we going to do now? So now I've got to do self-mortification, because I still have that terrible bad body that I know isn't good, you know, my soul's good. So part of what people did in early monasticism is they went off into the desert to mortify their flesh, to beat themselves with roped cords or chains, to starve themselves, to practice extreme asceticism, to purge this evil body from sin. I always find it interesting that most of these folks that went out there were guys, and they always write about Satan attacking them, and the way Satan always attacked them was never giving them lumbago or a big toe inflammation. It was always with visions of women and sex. And so women became very bad. They became the devil. Okay? In a cultural anthropological perspective, those people that create the main stories are usually the ones that get to define who the bad people are. Men have created most of the main stories within the West, so women got to be the evil temptress. Okay? In societies where women create the stories, men play that role, by the way. So, and it's not just related to Christianity. When Siddhartha Gautama, when the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree for his final phase of being enlightened, he was attacked by demons, and the demons took the form of all these beautiful girls that danced around him. So it's not just Christianity that seems to want to make women devils. Not that you can't be ladies, but in general, that just is what happens here. So you have all these guys out there mortifying the flesh and doing this, and it's working pretty well. It's real popular in northern Africa and Palestine because you have a lot of desert. You got a lot of caves. It's very easy to do that. As monasticism filtered up in through the East and up into around Rome and into Italy, it became harder to do that because you don't have a lot of desert and caves. Italy doesn't have a lot of desert. Okay, so while it was always individual, as it moved up into the East and the West, especially in the West, these guys started to live in groups. It just got easier that way. And in the West, monasticism became a communal exercise. You would get together with a bunch of guys and say, okay, we're going to forsake the world. Well, it really isn't a desert, so we're going to live in this little shack under this nice olive tree, and we'll be okay. And we'll still forsake the world, but it'll be a little cozier than that guy out in the desert cave down in northern Africa. Well, one of the great guys, the key guy of monasticism, was this guy named Benedict. Benedict was born in this little town, Nursia, there in Italy. He was born around 480, late 5th century, 480. And Benedict was a really great guy, okay? And he got so involved with monasticism that the thing that he did was he created sort of a plan, an administrative, sort of the how-to book of monasticism. It's known as the Rule. Nowadays, it's known as the Rule of Saint Benedict, because anybody that died in antiquity, we call a saint, right? And so the Rule of Saint Benedict gave us everything we needed to know about being a monk. Again, this is in the West. In the East, it was a little different. But my favorite thing, and sometimes I like the funny things that we find in history, Santa Claus slapping areas and whatnot. The Rule of Saint Benedict, section 40, is the amount of drink. Now this is, again, Benedict has regulated every aspect of daily life of the monks. And this is what he wrote. He said, we believe that one pint of wine a day is enough for each one of the monks. So he was okay with that. He said, let those whom God gives the ability to endure abstinence know that they will have their reward. He said, indeed, we read that wine is not suitable for monks at all, but because in our day, around the early 6th century, in our day it's not possible to persuade the monks of this truth. So we'll agree to the fact that they should not drink in excess, so we'll just give them one pint of wine a day. Right, and he says if you're in, and he says the same thing about different food and whatnot. So in their beds, he felt that they shouldn't just sleep on the floor on a slab; they should actually have a blanket and a pillow. So Benedict creates this order for monastic life, and the idea is communal. And the two things that Benedict stressed, two most important things, were obedience and prayer. Now this is really important. Obedience for two reasons. One, it makes the monastery run well. Part of monastic life means that you give up your individuality. They have uniforms. They wear robes. Okay? They all look the same. They shave their head. They all take different names. There's a wonderful place, if you're ever traveling up Highway 14, you get off on Pear Blossom Highway before you kind of go over into the Lancaster-Palmdale area. Go up Pear Blossom Highway to a little town called Viermo. And in Viermo, there's a Benedictine monastery. And it's a great little joint. Every year they have a wonderful fall festival. And it's in the high desert, so it's hot there in the summer. The monks are running around in these big robes, okay? And they all wear these robes. And they follow the rule of St. Benedict. Today, modern 21st century guys. But the thing about monasticism is obedience was important. Everybody had to be obedient to the rule of St. Benedict. Everybody in the monastery had to be obedient to the guy who was in charge, the abbot of the monastery. The abbot of the monastery had to be obedient to all his guys who were above him within the rule of St. Benedict. And ultimately, they had to be obedient to the Pope. You see, obedience was a very important thing. Well, this is good, because we'll see later on, the Pope sort of treats the monastery as his own private, almost like army, or his group of guys who help him get stuff done. So obedience becomes really important. And now Benedict taught it for one reason, but the reality, it worked really well socially and politically. The second thing that Benedict taught was prayer. While the monk's life was to be spent working and being self-sufficient and doing, the focus of the monk's life was to continually pray to God. And Benedict took the idea of pray continually, you know, when Paul says that in the New Testament, as literally to pray continually. So what they did was they went back and followed the biblical model of how at the temple, you know, there were set times for prayer and sacrifice every day, and we know that you know, the apostles and Jesus went to pray at certain times. Well, Benedict in his rule decided that the monks needed to have this same model. And following the sort of the outline of the Bible, they developed, and it's anywhere from 7 to 9 times a day that you stopped everything you were doing and you had communal prayer when you're in the monastery. To this day, they still do that, okay? And you do it in the morning when you get up, and then you do it when you're eating, and then you do it in the middle of the morning, and then you do it at midday, and then you do it in the afternoon, and then you do it in the evening, and then you have scripture reading and prayer during dinner, and then at night before you go to bed, and then in the middle of the night you get up and you do it again. Okay, so this constant prayer. Well, one of the things that happened with constant prayer is that the prayer was mostly this reciting and singing of the Psalms. Okay, the 150 Psalms. Well, the more monasteries you have, the more guys you have, you can't teach everybody to memorize 150 Psalms in Latin. So you've got to have songbooks. You've got to have hymnals for everybody, right? So the monastery, because it's self-sufficient, they have to create their own. So the monks are proficient now at writing and copying and making books. Well, that's a huge advantage. Because not only do you make prayer books and hymnals to sing out of, but now you can copy other books. And the monastery likes to have its own library, so as folks have books, they're copying them. Up in Ireland, the monasteries in Ireland, they copied everything. So later on, after all the, you know, 1,000 years later, after all the killing and pillaging subsided and the Arabs had got in conquest their area and everything settled, everybody went, oh, shoot. Everybody burned all those books. Everybody burned all those things. And the monasteries went, oh, no, we got a copy back here because we made a copy of that. So this idea of constant prayer and the need for a prayer book created the need to create a publishing complex. And each monastery did this. So while Benedict wanted them to be holy and pray continually, the good news for society was that these guys started to create books and libraries and copies of things. So we have a whole lot of stuff, including copies of the New Testament, that survived a pretty brutal period because somebody in a monastery somewhere copied it. Now, they made beautiful copies. You see some of these things, the artwork is incredible. Nowadays, you know, we go on our computers and we open up our Word, you know, and we bang away in Times New Roman font, 12 point, and we get done and we send it off to print. These guys were doing it by hand. And they would draw beautiful pictures, and they would draw big first letters, and they would draw little grapevines in the margin, and they made these beautiful things out of these books. So not only did you have a tremendous amount of intellectual content preserved through the monasteries, but you had beautiful artwork coming out of this period of time. If you think of all the barbarians and all those guys out there just mucking about trying to get a nice house for their wife and 12 kids and their sheep and goats, they're the blue-collar workers of the day. The monks, they were the white-collar guys. They were the university guys of the medieval period, okay? They were involved in all this sort of stuff. Most of the great folks that come up through the ranks that we read about in church history came out of these sort of settings. Very few of them were some child of a Hun who, you know, forsake his tent and his goats and decided to be a great theologian. The majority of folks that we end up getting in this period of church history come or are affected by these monasteries. They're taught in a monastery or they come out of a monastery. These were really the sort of places that preserved the culture. Okay? And that was the main thing that went on during this whole period. Now the second thing is the papacy. I don't think I'll get to all of this tonight. I'll try. Nowadays, as Protestants and as evangelical Protestants, we are just taught that we don't like the Pope. Okay, well, I mean, that's just what we're taught, right? There was a book years ago that claimed that the Pope is the Antichrist and that the Church of Rome is the Whore of Babylon spoken about in the Book of Revelation. And I grew up with these little pamphlets that they gave out by a guy named Chick, and they were black and red and they were terrible and they were strong anti-Catholic things. So we're all taught that we don't like the Pope. And whenever we talk about the Pope, we have to say, yes, he's a bad guy. And even if you like him, if you get a real likable one like John Paul II that everybody said, he's a pretty nice guy. I mean, you know, he's really good. He sort of saved Poland from the communists and he likes little kids. And even a really nice guy like that, we still say, oh, yeah, but theologically he's evil, you know. So, but the papacy, we've got to contend with it. That was a huge part of this. And the papacy is a huge part of why the church survived this whole period of time. So I want to look at, and there were a whole bunch of popes, okay. But since this isn't a Catholic church, I don't have to name all of them individually. I just want to focus on three of them, and I want to make what I'll call a Pope Leo sandwich, okay? The first pope I want to talk about is Pope Leo I. The last pope I'm going to talk about is Pope Leo III. In between was Pope Gregory I. So we're going to make a Leo sandwich with Gregory as the meat in between the two pieces of bread. Wonderful pedagogical tool, I think, for remembering this. At the time, Rome was trying to figure out how do we maintain power and how do we maintain society in some orderly manner. And the one thing that Roman leaders found out was that, you know, these Christians pay attention, at least around Rome, they pay attention to the head bishop, which is who we call the Pope. The word Pope, by the way, is just the word for father, okay? And it really wasn't technically used as the official job title of the guy for a while, but they said the Bishop of Rome is the guy we listen to, and they refer to the Bishop of Rome as the Holy See, S-E-E, not S-E-A, as the center of the Christian church in the West. Well, the Roman officials said, look, we've got to make this guy the guy, because if people start disagreeing with him, then they're going to start disagreeing with us, and society will just fall apart. So, in around the end of the 5th century, Valentinian created this edict. Now, there's some background on this. There was a guy named Hilary, Bishop Hilary, who was arguing with Pope Leo the First at the time, 440, 445, somewhere around in there, very beginning of this medieval period, before the fall of Rome. And Hilary was arguing with him, and it was causing all kinds of problems. So Valentinian, in order to hold the peace and in order to make sure Rome politically was safe and whatnot, said, no, everybody has to agree with the Pope in Rome, with the Bishop of Rome. Everybody's got to agree with this. And now, as the leader of the Roman Empire, I am going to officially create this edict that tells everybody they have to agree with the Bishop of Rome, with the Pope, which at the time was Leo I. And Valentinian said, we are convinced that the only defense for us and for our empire, for Rome, is in the favor of God of heaven. And in order to deserve the favor, this favor, the favor of God in heaven, it is our first care to support the Christian faith, the most venerable religion. So, he says, in order for Rome to exist, we got to have God's grace. In order to have God's grace, we've got to be really good to the Christian church. Therefore, he says, inasmuch as the preeminence of the apostolic see of the bishop in Rome is assured by the merit of St. Peter, the very first of all bishops, by the leading position of the city of Rome, the fact that the bishop is in Rome and not out somewhere in a tiny little town somewhere, and by the authority of the Holy Synod, all the bishops, let not presumption strive to attempt anything contrary to the order of that see. In other words, in modern English, everybody has to agree with the Pope. In order for everything, for God to be okay with us, everybody has to agree with the Pope. And he says, for the peace of churches will only then be everywhere preserved when the whole body acknowledges its ruler. Hitherto, this has been observed without violation, but this guy Hilary, and we've learned from the report of that venerable man, Leo, the Pope of Rome, Leo I, that this guy Hilary, through presumptuous proceedings, has created confusion and invaded the church, and blah, 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 blah. So Valentinian ends the edict, but so whatever the authority of the apostolic see has enacted or shall enact, let that be held as law for all. In other words, whatever the Pope says is rule for the land. Okay, that's what the Edict of Valentinian said, and Pope Leo was that Pope. He was, and he encouraged Valentinian to do this because Leo wanted his position as Pope to be really important. Now, Leo made sure of this in a really amazing way. Leo was no slouch. Leo was a brilliant politician and negotiator. And he was a really gutsy guy. And Leo realized, we've got all these barbarians just barking at the door here. You know, Rome had been invaded by the Goths and the Vandals and the Visigoths and all these things. And it's really ugly right now. So I could really make sure that everybody thinks that I'm a great guy as Pope if I can help stem some of this destruction of Rome. Because quite frankly, unless Leo fled Rome, he would probably be destroyed too. Well, Leo really, as they would say on The Sopranos, really made his bones when Attila the Hun showed up at the doorstep of Rome. Attila the Hun was getting ready to invade Rome, and it was going to be really ugly because Attila was not a gentle, a gracious guy. He had the, you know, slash and burn philosophy, right? So Attila's set. He's ready to invade Rome. Leo gets a bunch of his priests, gets up and marches out of Rome to stand right in front of Attila as he's getting ready to come into Rome with his army. And he talks him down. Leo gets Attila to go, okay, I'm not going to invade Rome. That's an amazing thing. That is an amazing thing. Now, depending on how you hear the story, the general story is that Attila saw a vision given by God, that as Leo came walking up to him, Attila saw St. Peter and St. Paul and some of the heavenly army there. And he thought, uh-oh, this is serious business. Remember, Attila was an Arian Christian. So it wasn't like he was just some run-of-the-mill pagan guy that didn't get this stuff, okay? Attila would have been familiar with the whole Christian paradigm. So however it worked, whatever skillful negotiation Leo had, he talked Attila down, and Attila did not attack Rome. Okay? A couple of years later, here comes another attack on Rome by the Vandals. I always get this guy's name wrong. I always get it wrong. I always want to say Gensarius, and that's close to his name, but it's not the correct pronunciation. Genseric. Thank you, Genseric. Oh, it's in our book actually. 243. He was leader of the Vandals. Third paragraph, last sentence. Genseric. It's not important that you know his name. I just like to always put names on people, and for some reason I have trouble with him. I always had back in when I took this. When I took church history back in seminary, I always got that one wrong on the test. The synapses don't work for him somehow. Anyway, Genseric was leader of the Vandals. Now, he attacked Rome, so Leo didn't stop him at the gates. But as he's getting ready to burn the place, Leo did convince him not to burn Rome down. So twice within a period of less than 5 years, Pope Leo saves Rome. That is a huge amount of street cred. Okay, there is no way around it. This guy is now hugely powerful, because not only did the Emperor of Rome say everybody has to pay attention to the Pope, but he went out and actually saved Rome from Attila and from Gensarius. That's a big deal. Leo the First is the guy that really put the papacy on the map. Yeah.
When Leo marched to meet Attila the Hun, were the priests armed? I mean, were they there as an army, or were they just there to?
No, he went as a religious leader. Not army versus army.
Okay.
We've seen this happen occasionally in history. The high priest went out to meet. Remember back. In intertestamental period, went out and again God intervened there. So, but they went out as religious people, and a lot of folks make a parallel here between that. But he went out as Leo went out as a religious man. He did not go out with the Roman army. Remember, the Roman army was in its last shreds at this point in time. Anyway, they're being defeated all over the outskirts of Rome. In fact, they were non-existent the way Attila came in. Remember, Attila was up here, up over. If Rome is here, Attila was up. I'm sorry. If Rome was here, Attila was up over here. For those of you listening on the CD, I'm waving my hands wildly around the room, imitating a map of Europe. So he went out there. Yes, he went out unarmed. So this guy was good. Now, it could be that God intervened there. There's nothing to say that he didn't. There's also nothing to say that he didn't. But the story is that Attila saw Peter and Paul and the heavenly host and went, well, okay, we won't come in there. But Leo really put the papacy on the map. In fact, I take this view because I'm Protestant and not Catholic. Leo was really, of the modern way that we think of the Pope, it started with Leo. It didn't start back with, Linus or whoever the second guy was and the third and the fourth guy along, right? The papacy really started with Leo, okay? Now, Leo died, and everything shredded because there just wasn't another Leo around, right? And so you got about 130, 150 years, and everybody's still, they're invading Rome, and all the barbarians, and the church is fighting itself over Arianism and over other stuff, and the Eastern Church is starting to try to sneak in and get a little piece of the action because, Constantinople always wanted to be the big guy and had to share the stage with Rome. So all this is going on, And you just get all this strange stuff happening. The only other thing that I loved about this was the guy that came after Pope Leo the First. I just love his name because it's a homonym. But the guy was named Pope Hilarius, and I always just love that because he always just thinks this guy going, "Oh, this is so funny." But it's not spelled the same way; it just sounds the same. So you have all this stuff going on. Now that the big deal at the time was the big evil folks at the time that were beating everybody up wasn't the Huns and it wasn't the Vandals or anybody now. It was now the Lombards, okay, and they're coming in, and they're really wreaking havoc in Rome, okay, and it's getting really bad because the the Roman army is no longer available, and Rome is just destroyed, and the infrastructure is gone. You know, the aqueducts are destroyed, and they're not getting shipments of food. And on top of all of this, there's this huge epidemic, and so now you got all these people dying from disease, right? So it's really ugly in Rome, and this is probably 135, 140 years later after Leo. And the Pope at the time is Pope Pelagius II, not related to Pelagius, the bad guy that we'll talk about in later, but Pelagius II, and he's actually doing everything he can to clean up Rome because it's just so bad at the time. Now, remember I said that the monasteries, that obedience was important and the popes would take advantage of that? Well, they did. Pelagius II rallied all the monks to help him, and they went out into the city and they started to bury the dead people from the epidemic, and they started to restructure the sanitation in Rome and to get the water flowing, and they fed people. And Pelagius and these helper monks really started to get Roman society, just the infrastructure of the city, back into place while, you know, everybody's beating them up and everything. Well, Pelagius was so good at this, and he was so good at burying the dead people, he actually got this disease himself, and he died. He was succeeded by his assistant, this guy Gregory I. Now, Gregory I really never, when you read about him, he never really wanted to be pope. He was happy sort of just running the joint. He was a really good guy. He knew how to get things done, and he took over and said, okay, we need to straighten the whole area out. So he put together this sort of city beautification plan, rebuild the aqueducts, get the grain supply coming back up from Sicily and from the south so that people had food. Gregory went in there and he really got Rome back on its feet. Okay, he was the guy that, and I'm not talking theologically here, he was the guy that made sure people weren't dying and starving and that the streets worked and everything. Gregory was a smart guy, and he got this done. He used a lot of the monks and whatnot to help him. The other thing that Gregory did was that he loved to write. He was a theologian. But Gregory was sort of a man of his time. He was very superstitious. He just loved Augustine. And I talked about Augustine last week as one of the two great, Augustine and Jerome to me were the two great guys of late ancient period. And Gregory loved Augustine. And Gregory sort of in his mind set Augustine up as the sort of infallible theological source. So much so that he misinterpreted what Augustine said. But because it was Augustine, and this is what Gregory thought he said, this became official rule. It was during Gregory's time that we now have this powerful papacy, and the papacy is used to now create a lot of those things in the church that still exist in the Roman church today that the Protestants fought against in the Reformation. All of that stuff started during Gregory's. The Mass as being an unbloody redoing of the sacrifice of Christ. The sacraments. Priestly celibacy. Actually, that started under Pelagius, but Gregory was a big... Well, actually, you know, to be fair to Gregory, Pelagius was huge on that. Gregory wanted to relax the rules a little bit. On that, but he still was for it. Greg,
how did it come about?
The general thought was, okay, this does not reflect the opinion of Hadavar or ICC or any of its affiliated members. Remember how I talked about that this whole idea of the body as being evil?
Yes.
And women being sort of tools of the devil? The thought was that as a person, you know, just general Joe Sixpack kind of guy, working all day, coming home to the wife and kids, it was okay for you to have a wife and to have kids and to have sex. That was probably all right because you were just a regular kind of guy, scratching out a living. But if you were going to serve God, you know, if you were going to dedicate your life, if you were going to be a priest, you probably should remove yourself from that life. And if you're really going to serve God, you really have to dedicate your whole life to Him. And you're going to have to watch out because, you know, your body's evil. And you're going to desire a lot of things physically. And one of them is going to be sex. And so you're going to want to go out and get a wife, but that's not really dedicating yourself to God. And because we all know sex is kind of bad anyway, because, you know, that's evil, we probably should make you pure, and you should just remain celibate. It's not uncommon. Many religions have a celibacy as part of the religion. Most of those religions don't go on very long as they have celibacy, because you can't make more people of your religious idea if you don't have kids. Yeah. And you know, you even look at the Essenes, the monastic Jewish group that went out in the desert. You even look at modern American history. The Quakers. Well, the Shakers believed in celibacy. We don't have large Shaker churches anymore because they were very good at celibacy. They didn't have kids, so you don't get more little Shakers, right? So the idea that we have to keep ourselves physically pure to serve God meant that you shouldn't take a wife, and that ultimately, you know, you probably shouldn't do those things that every common people do. So the idea of a celibate priesthood. Now, this didn't go all the way down to the priest level like it is today. They started out saying, well, if you're just a regular priest, you can have a wife. Up to a certain level, you can go ahead and get married. Once you hit sort of bishop, well, then you probably shouldn't be married. And then the big discussion came in, well, what do you do with a guy who's already married who goes up to be bishop? Or what do you do with a guy who's married who wants to be a priest and now you said they can't have wives? Well, the initial thing was, you say, yeah, great, come on in, we're going to get rid of your wife. And they just basically broke up the marriage and sent her off somewhere. The Eastern Church today, the Orthodox Church, allows priests to be married up to the level of bishop. Within Protestant churches, they do allow, you know, some married formal clergy, like the Episcopal Church, Lutheran Church, to still have wives. In the evangelical circles, we don't care. I mean, in fact, we would think a celibate senior pastor would be a little weird, and he probably wouldn't get voted in, right? But the idea of celibacy for everybody really came out of this period, and Gregory was in support of it. Pelagius was more than Gregory. Gregory was in support of it. So anyway, Gregory started to do all this stuff theologically. And since it's 8 o'clock, I can't tell you what that is. But next week at 7 o'clock, I can tell you what it is. And we'll look at that. And we'll continue this. I was hoping next week to get into the Eastern split. We may still have time to do that. But okay, see you all next week.